Workplace Gender Equality Agency. It's coming up to news time. After the 7 o'clock news AM with Sabra Lane, we'll be looking at an innovative program teaching how women to ride bikes later in life. And we'll talk to Richard Miles after 7:30. It's news time.
Good morning, Sarah Hall with ABC News. Moscow has warned the use of Western-supplied long-range missiles against Russia by Ukraine could trigger a nuclear response. More from Michelle Rimmer.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has approved a change to Russia's nuclear doctrine to allow the use of nuclear weapons in response to a conventional missile attack supported by a country with nuclear capabilities. The move comes amid reports the US has given Ukraine approval to fire Western-supplied long-range missiles into Russian territory, something Russia's defense ministry claims Ukraine has now done. It says six ATACMS missiles were fired from Ukraine into Russia's Bryansk region. Ukrainian authorities are yet to confirm the report.
United States negotiators say a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanese militant group Hezbollah is within reach. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
Talks of a truce getting closer and closer have been simmering for weeks as the US tries to convince Israel and Hezbollah to agree to end fighting. US Special Envoy Amos Hochstein's arrived in Beirut for further talks, positive about the prospects.
It is now within our grasp.
Aside from the obvious and most important benefit of a ceasefire, being the safety of the civilian population, striking a deal would also be a political win for US President Joe Biden in his last months in office. Matthew Doran, ABC News, Jerusalem.
The Australian government has committed an extra $50 million towards a global fund to deal with the loss and damage caused by climate change. Here's Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek.
The government made the commitment at the United Nations Climate Summit in Azerbaijan. Australia is one of the key parties in Baku, where governments are negotiating how much rich countries, who are the biggest polluters, should pay poor countries to cope with climate change. Minister Chris Bowen says the new commitment makes Australia the sixth largest contributor to the Fund for Loss and Damage. The funding's been welcomed, but environment groups say Australia can still do more to reduce fossil fuel use and exports.
Millions of commuters across Sydney are bracing for major disruptions as railway workers prepare to go on strike from tomorrow night and over the weekend. Jessica Kidd reports.
Members of the Rail, Tram and Bus Union will go on strike from 10 p.m. Thursday until 6 a.m. on Sunday after pay negotiations with the state government broke down. Union Secretary Toby Warns has laid the blame on the state government, saying it refused union demands to run 24-hour train services on Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights.
All it takes is a couple of trains running on our tracks between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. and this whole situation can be averted.
Transport Minister Joe Halen says it's not sustainable to run permanent 24-hour services, arguing it would lead to the failure of the rail network.
Transport for New South Wales is arranging alternative services but is warning passengers to avoid peak travel times and make other arrangements. And in breaking news, the Rail, Tram and Bus Union has agreed to run a regular train service on Thursday, including 86 special event services planned for the Pearl Jam concert at Sydney Olympic Park. The breakthrough follows a meeting between the union and Sydney Trains last night. Transport for New South Wales says the union has not agreed to lift its planned industrial actions, which means the rail network will shut down on Friday and Saturday and through until Sunday morning. Two men have been charged in relation to the suspicious disappearance of missing Melbourne teenager Isla Bell. Costa Haritos reports.
Detectives arrested three men from Melbourne's southeast after searching two properties in Bentley East and Mulgrave yesterday. It comes after the missing persons squad located remains believed to be those of the missing 19-year-old in Dandenong. Officers charged a 53-year-old male with murder, while a 57-year-old male was charged with assisting an offender with murder. A 63-year-old male from Mulgrave was also arrested but later released. Police say they are supporting Miss Bell's family, who haven't seen her since she disappeared on the evening of the 4th of October.
And wealthy private schools are among the top targets of online hackers, according to a new report by Australia's cyber spy agency. The annual threat assessment from the Australian Signals Directorate says small businesses are being hit with higher average costs from cyber crimes. This is ABC News. Women's safety advocates say the use of doxing by domestic violence perpetrators isn't receiving the attention it deserves. Doxing refers to the malicious release of personal information online. The federal government is seeking to criminalise the practice as part of broader privacy reform, but is yet to secure support from the opposition and the Greens. National Women's Safety Alliance Director Catherine Burney says she's hopeful both parties will support the change.
We can't escape the fact that these negative behaviours disproportionately affect women and children, and that means that we have an obligation then to ensure that we are offering the appropriate protections as the tech develops.
Prosecutors in New York have agreed to Donald Trump's sentencing in the hush money case being postponed. Here's North America correspondent Barbara Miller.
Prosecutors have written to the judge in Donald Trump's hush money case saying they're not opposed to a further delay in his sentencing while legal motions play out, but have argued Trump could still be sentenced after his second four-year term in the White House. Donald Trump's lawyers say the case should be dismissed now that he is the president-elect. The decision now rests with the judge, but it looks likely that the sentencing could be postponed indefinitely. The hush money case is the only one of four criminal cases against Donald Trump that went to trial. Barbara Miller, ABC News, Washington.
Two Melbourne women, both aged 19, remain on life support in Thailand after a suspected mass methanol poisoning, which has claimed the lives of two young Danish women. Southeast Asia correspondent Lauren Day reports.
Holly Bowles and Bianca Jones are both understood to be in a critical condition in two separate hospitals in Thailand, with their families by their bedsides. They'd been on a gap year adventure through Asia when they fell ill in the Laos party town of Vang Vieng last week after drinking cocktails believed to be laced with methanol. The Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs has now confirmed two Danish women have died in Laos. The ABC understands they were also best friends and also on a gap year. Government website Smart Traveller has now issued warnings to travellers about the poisonings, urging people to be alert to the potential risks.
Thousands of British farmers have held a rally in central London to protest against changes to inheritance tax announced last month. The new rules mean that from April 2026, inherited agricultural assets worth more than $1.8 million will be liable to a 20% tax. The largest estimate suggests 70,000 farms could be affected overall, but the annual sum is likely to be around 500. The National Dictionary Centre at the Australian National University has chosen Colesworth as its word of the year, reflecting growing frustration directed at Australia's top supermarkets. Justina Basta reports.
It's a word that describes the perceived duopoly of Australia's largest supermarket retailers, Coles and Woolworths. The year has seen growing dissatisfaction at supermarket prices, which sparked an inquiry by the corporate watchdog. Mark Gwynne from the ANU's Dictionary Centre says the word reflects changing attitudes towards the retailers.
It certainly spiked this year as people started to become quite cynical.
Words on the shortlist include breaking, the common term for breakdancing after Australian athlete Ray Gunn's viral performance at the Olympics.
Now with sport, here's Daniel Garb.
Australian batter Manus Labuschagne has claimed India will be lacking confidence heading into this week's first test in Perth. India arrived in Australia off the back of a 3-0 test series loss at home to New Zealand. Labuschagne says that's handy for the Aussie team.
Not coming off a test victory, losing to New Zealand 3-0, I think that's going to do a little bit damage to their confidence.
Major winner Cameron Smith says the disappointment of last year's poor showing at the Australian PGA has spurred him on for this year's tournament, which begins tomorrow at Royal Queensland. Smith has won the event three times, but was well below his best last year and let his frustration show as he missed the cut.
It was terrible. It was a terrible feeling. That was definitely part of the motivation to to get up and get ready for this week.
And the 2024 AFL National Draft begins tonight with the first round of selections to be made in Melbourne. Richmond holds a remarkable 7 picks in the opening round as they rebuild their list following the departure of several premiership heroes. That includes pick 1, which is widely expected to be used on Victoria Country midfielder Sam Lawler.
To finance, Wall Street stocks are mixed after Moscow said Ukraine sent missiles provided by the US into Russian territory for the first time. The Australian share market is set to open a 0.25% higher later this morning. The global benchmark Brent crude is higher at $73.30 US a barrel, and the Australian dollar is higher at 65.3 US cents. You're up to date with the latest ABC News.
Across Australia, you're listening to Breakfast on ABC Radio National.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Moscow says Ukraine's fired US-supplied long-range missiles into Russia for the first time. The Kremlin's describing the attack as an escalation by the West. The development follows reports that United States President Joe Biden gave Ukraine the go-ahead on the weekend to fire the weapons into Russian territory, something Kyiv had requested months ago. Michelle Rimmer has this report.
More than a year ago, Ukraine was given long-range US-made ATACMS missiles that can strike targets 300 kilometres away. But they were given to Ukraine under the condition they could only be used against Russian targets on Ukrainian soil. Following reports, the US has now lifted that restriction. Russia says Ukraine has fired 6 ATACMS missiles into its Bryansk border region. Russia's defence ministry says 5 of the missiles were shot down and fragments from the 6th fell on a military facility, causing a fire. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has condemned the attack, which he claims could not have happened without the West's endorsement.
The fact that the missiles were used repeatedly in the Bryansk region, of course, it's a signal that they want to escalate the conflict, and it's impossible for Ukraine to use these high-tech missiles without the Americans.
Ukrainian officials have not confirmed or denied the use of long-range weapons to strike inside Russia, but Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky responded to the reports by reiterating his intention to use the weapons at his disposal.
I won't go into the details, but Ukraine has long-range capabilities. We have long-range drones made in Ukraine, and now we have ATACMS, and we will use them and all of their capabilities.
In September, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the use of long-range missiles to strike inside Russia's border would amount to direct involvement of NATO countries in the war in Ukraine. He's now approved a change to Russia's nuclear doctrine to allow the use of nuclear weapons in response to a conventional missile attack, which is supported by a nuclear power. The European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, has labelled the threat of nuclear escalation completely irresponsible.
Any call for nuclear warfare is an irresponsibility. We have to call it the way it is. It is not the first time that Putin plays the nuclear game ball. It's not the first time that he uses everything he can in order to create insecurity. But to call for the nuclear, to talk about nuclear deterrence, is something that we strongly reject.
Both the United Kingdom and France are yet to announce whether they'll now allow Ukraine to use Storm Shadow long-range missiles they've supplied to strike targets inside Russia. This is Michelle Rimmer reporting for AM.
There are renewed calls for Australia to reopen its embassy in Kyiv. And after 7.30 on Radio National Breakfast, Steve Kinnane will interview the Acting Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Marles. Australia's gender pay gap is narrowed a little. Some advocates say it's scandalous that there's still a gap. It's dropped 0.6% to just over 21%. The federal government's decision to boost the wages of low-paid, mainly female workers is one of the main reasons for that. From next year, companies will have to disclose their progress, and campaigners say naming and shaming them might lead to big change. With more, here's Lexi Junowick.
Australia is home to more women than men.
But in the workforce, it's still a man's world, according to the Workplace Gender Equality Agency's latest gender equality scorecard.
There's still a very significant way to go.
WGEA CEO Mary Wooldridge says women earn 78 cents for every dollar men earn, or around $28,000 less each year. But she says it's not all bad news for women in the workplace.
The gender pay gap, which reflects the average total remuneration for men and women and the difference between the two, has come down a further 0.6 percentage points. Now, it's not a lot, but it continues to trend in the right direction.
Mary Wooldridge says a key factor in the tightening of the gap has been the increased wages of our low-paid workers, including in residential aged care.
We continue to want to see improvements in the gender pay gap, reflecting the increase in earnings for those low-paid feminised industries.
This report comes off the back of a separate analysis by the Australian Council of Trade Unions released this week, which put the gender pay gap at 11.5%. WGEA's report calls for action in several areas, especially around those working closest to the so-called glass ceiling, with just one in four CEOs or heads of business women.
It doesn't surprise me, but I do wish the figure was much higher. I think we've made some great progress, but we've got a long way to go.
Stella Smith is the chief executive of not-for-profit Crime Stoppers Victoria.
I'm hoping that over the next few years, as more and more women move into management positions, that they get those opportunities to step further up the ladder.
Professor Ray Cooper is the founding director of the Australian Centre for Gender Equality and Inclusion at Work. She believes closing the gap is a shared responsibility between the federal government and employers.
It's scandalous that we have a gap at all. We need to be examining the data, and businesses and governments need to be working out what levers they have to be able to address the drivers of those problems and to take action to make change.
WGEA is due to release its second report into what progress some of our biggest companies have made in improving gender equity in February next year. Echoing Professor Ray Cooper,
there's nothing like a bit of name and shame to get people to focus their attention.
Honorary Associate Professor Sally Moyle from Australia National University's Gender Institute says having information like this in the open is crucial to driving change.
I hope that we will see that that continues to focus their mind and that they continue to pay attention to the data and the analysis.
That's Honorary Associate Professor Sally Moyle from the Australian National University Gender Institute, ending that report from Lexi Junawick. Senate's debating privacy reforms this week, and it will look at the malicious public release of personal information known as doxing and criminalising the act. Women's safety campaigners say doxing by domestic violence perpetrators has been largely overlooked during the debate. The opposition has yet to finalise a position. The Greens want doxing dealt with separately, and advocates have been lobbying senators to get attention on the problem. Political reporter Nicole Hegarty has more.
Doxing made headlines in February when the personal details of 600 Jewish Australians were leaked online by pro-Palestinian advocates. The government then committed to criminalise the practice as part of Privacy Act changes. But women's safety advocates say doxing is affecting victims of domestic violence too.
The experiences of people who have had that tech-facilitated abuse are sort of being neglected in terms of another narrative.
Catherine Burney is the executive director of the National Women's Safety Alliance and says the use of doxing by perpetrators of domestic violence isn't receiving the attention it should. One case even involved a man listing his former partner's address online as a prostitution service, leading men to her property at all hours. Catherine Burney says while much of the focus has been on what happened to the Jewish Australians, women and children are disproportionately affected by doxing.
From the conversations that I've had with victim survivors, there are always threats to release their personal information online.
She's been meeting with politicians in Canberra this week to highlight that point, saying there needs to be a crackdown on doxing.
What we need is to ensure that we have consistent powers that see this as a crime.
The offence is included as part of a larger suite of Privacy Act changes to be discussed in the Senate this week. The opposition is yet to finalise its position on those changes, while the Greens have called for doxing to be dealt with separately. Catherine Burney says she's hopeful her meetings have convinced the undecideds of the bill's merits.
I think we've had some really productive conversations.
Attorney General Mark Dreyfus says there are terrible examples of victim survivors being doxxed, and the reforms would penalise the practice with up to 7 years jail.
Women and children experiencing domestic, family and sexual violence are very often targets.
He says creating the offence would send a clear message that the behaviour doesn't meet community standards.
I call on all members of the Parliament to support this essential legislation. It's going to improve the safety of all Australians, particularly the safety of women and children.
With the Greens raising concerns, advocates' appeals could prove key in deciding whether the reforms will pass.
Nicole Hegarty there. You're listening to AM and it's 19 past 7. For more news, you can download the ABC Listen app. Hong Kong media mogul Jimmy Lai will give evidence today for the first time since his detention as his national security trial resumes after a months-long delay. If found guilty, the 77-year-old could spend the rest of his life in jail. His case follows the sentencing of 45 pro-democracy activists, academics and ex-lawmakers for up to 10 years. East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood is in Hong Kong and is following the cases.
Emotions were high as people filed out of Hong Kong's West Kowloon Court. 45 pro-democracy activists, academics and former politicians have finally been sentenced for their roles in an unofficial primary election, nearly 4 years after being arrested. It's the latest blow to the city's political freedoms after a broad crackdown, including the introduction of Beijing's national security law following widespread protests in 2019. Local activist Sun Kin-shing is pessimistic about the situation.
Freedom is becoming rarer in Hong Kong. It's very unfortunate. Australians are lucky.
Legal academic Benny Tai was hit with the longest sentence of 10 years, having been labelled the so-called mastermind of the vote. Australian citizen Gordon Ng was handed 7 years and 3 months, which has been condemned by the Foreign Minister Penny Wong and her coalition counterpart. Chan Po Ying, whose husband Long Hair was sentenced to 6 years and 9 months, is furious.
I want to emphasise one thing very clear, that it is unfair trial and it's an unreasonable trial, so even one day, they don't deserve.
For days now, there's been a line outside the court ahead of this case. While it's now over, more observers had started to wait outside the court again not long after the sentence. They're hoping to listen to the evidence of Jimmy Lai, media mogul and one of the city's most well-known national security prisoners. Here's his son, Sebastian Lai.
My father has turned 77. He's been kept in solitary confinement in completely inhumane conditions for the last almost 4 years now. His health isn't very good. He doesn't get natural light. And because he's very religious, they've decided to not give him the sacrament of Holy Communion. So it's an incredibly horrible situation.
But even in jail, Mr. Lai is proving to be a sore spot for the Hong Kong and Chinese authorities. As a British citizen, the UK Prime Minister brought up Mr. Lai's case when he met with the Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the G20 in Brazil earlier this week, at which point the gathered press corps were ushered out of the room by Chinese officials.
Now, we are concerned by reports of Jimmy Lai's deterioration, health in prison.
And a few weeks ago, US President-elect Donald Trump made a pledge to raise the case with Xi Jinping directly while speaking to conservative commentator Hugh Hewitt.
100% I'll get him out. He'll be easy to get out.
Here's Sebastian Lai again.
So I'm incredibly grateful for that. I really hope to see my father again. I really hope that he is released from jail before he passes away. And I really hope that America and the UK can help secure my father's release as soon as possible.
Jimmy Lai will be giving evidence when the trial resumes, something which could go on for weeks. This is Kathleen Calderwood reporting from Hong Kong for AM.
The heavy civilian death toll in northern Gaza and alleged forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the area is fueling accusations the Israeli Defence Forces are planning something more than just simply targeting Hamas. Much of that is based on the existence of a plan put forward by a group of former Israeli generals, effectively calling for the north of the territory to be cut off from the rest of Gaza. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran's spoken with one of the former top brass.
In a modest office adorned with mementos and awards from a long military career, former Israeli Army General Giora Eiland offers some free and frank character assessments for his detractors.
This criticism comes from two kind of people. The first are ignorant, people who know nothing, and the other kind of people are evil people who are against Israel.
Giora Eiland's critics have taken aim at a proposal he's become the frontman for, commonly referred to in Israel as the General's Plan, a blueprint which he says is necessary to defeat Hamas in northern Gaza, a victory he believes is eluding the IDF so far.
I could save the lives of all the civilians there and force the combatants there either to surrender or to die.
Giora Eiland's plan would involve encircling around a third of Gaza. For a week or so, civilians in the north would be encouraged to leave through two safe corridors before all food, water and energy supplies are cut off. Anyone left behind treated as an enemy combatant, even if they're civilians.
And they would then be subject to starvation?
I mean, the safe corridor is open. In any time, they will be able to walk away.
He insists his plan doesn't breach international law, despite conventions which say starvation and displacement cannot be used as weapons of war. Giora Eiland says the Palestinians who leave would get to return home, with one caveat.
But of course they will not be able to return to this area before the Israeli hostages are returned.
Israel's ongoing siege of northern Gaza and its expansion of buffer zones between the area and the rest of the territory has led humanitarian groups to suggest it's already implementing the plan, something Giora Eiland rejects, saying the IDF has started its offensive with civilians still in place. The IDF too distancing itself from the proposal. Ofer Scheller used to serve underneath Giora Eiland and is now a director at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies.
Look, the general's plan is a red herring.
While brushing aside his former general's proposal, he warns Israel's current conduct in the north is dangerous.
It's bringing Israel every day closer to a position where it is regarded as de facto conquering and taking over Gaza, which will be disastrous both for our diplomacy and for our army.
The impact on humanitarian operations is already clear. UNICEF's Hamish Young saying the agency was forced to pause a polio vaccination rollout for Palestinian children under 10 due to the siege.
It was done under far less than ideal circumstances, and there were some strikes on some health facilities where polio was being administered.
But Giora Eiland won't be swayed, saying his plan is the best approach. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
They say you never forget how to ride a bike, but what if you've never had the opportunity to learn? And trying to pick up that skill later in life is challenging. In Western Australia, a program helping women get into the saddle for the first time is aiming to narrow the gender gap in the cycling community while bringing health and environment benefits. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
Okay, we're rolling now, getting ready to do a turn.
In a taped-off car park in Perth, they face their first challenge, sitting on a bicycle and pushing by foot without touching pedals.
Oh, lovely form. I can see you looking ahead. Well done.
Just 4 weeks later, the group of women graduate from the beginners program. Sarah Hassani is among those riding for the very first time.
Actually, I did find it very freeing as well. Like, it really opened up like a whole new world to me. And I really can't wait to keep practicing.
She hopes to commute to work on two wheels, but her seven-year-old daughter is the main reason for signing up.
She was like, why should I learn? If you don't know how to ride, why should I learn how to ride? I was like, I really regret not learning when I was your age. That's why I don't want you to go through the same, you know.
Erica Jongen was once part of a cycling group overseas, but lost confidence. Now at age 69, she's got it back.
To me, cycling's a great joy. I really appreciated the opportunity to experience that again.
The WA program is run by West Cycle. It began last year and is for women, transgender and non-binary people with little or no cycling experience. By partnering with various councils, the non-profit initiative brings free or cheap classes to the students. Bikes can be organised too. And those teaching the classes are women, including Jan O'Brien.
There is so many other cyclists out there which are generally men, and that makes it hard for women to feel comfortable on the bike. So I think programs like this, led by women, helps the women feel comfortable.
It's found a fan in Dr. Lauren Pearson, a specialist in gender and active transport at Monash University. She says it empowers women, improving their health, transport options and sense of community. And she argues that's particularly important because only one in three Australians who ride a bike are female.
Infrastructure is really that number one thing to create the enabling environment for people to be able to ride a bike safely. But we know that even when you provide the infrastructure, you still need that helping hand to be able to understand how it is that you use it. These programs are so important alongside infrastructure to be able to ensure that more people are able to ride a bike.
Back at class, Sarah Hassani is ready to inspire the next generation of female cyclists, starting with her daughter.
She's looking up to that now. She's like, if mum can do it, so can I.
New cyclist Sarah Hassani, ending Isabel Massali's report. In finance, Wall Street stocks are mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 0.33% lower. The Australian dollar is a little higher this morning. It's trading at 65.3 US cents. That's AM. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane at 7.30 and good morning, Steve Kinnane.
Morning, Sabra, and good morning, everyone. This is Radio National Breakfast. The top stories we're following this morning as Russia escalates the nuclear threat. A new parliamentary report calls for Australia to reopen its embassy in Ukraine and to send a military representative to the capital, Kyiv. The acting Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Marles, will be my guest next. Also this half hour, how committed are the Nationals to blocking the government's attempt to cap international student numbers, a move which it believes would benefit regional universities? That's what the government says anyway. The Nationals leader, David Littleproud, is my guest before 8 o'clock. First, though, Richard Crabtree is here with an update of the news headlines at 7.30. Morning, Richard.
Good morning, Steve. The Kremlin claims Ukraine has fired US-supplied missiles into the country for the first time, signalling a significant development in the war. Russia says its forces shot down all but one of the six missiles aimed at a military facility in an attack just one day after approval from the US to use the long-range weapons. The United States says an agreement to end the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah is within reach. Hezbollah has reportedly agreed to a ceasefire proposal from the US State Department. Israel says it would only agree if all its demands are met, including pushing Hezbollah away from the border. Australia has announced an extra $50 million towards a global loss and damage fund at the UN's climate summit in Azerbaijan. The fund aims to help the world's most vulnerable countries to cope with the loss and damage caused by climate change.